Welcome to the Federal News Update Evening Edition for Sunday, October 19th, 2025. We've spent the last 48 hours tracking every move the U.S. federal government has made, and frankly, the sheer audacity of what happened once Congress left town this weekend really demands a deep dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. It's good to be here. We've got a monumental task today. We want to give you a really comprehensive, granular look at every significant action, every activity, basically starting from the get-go on Friday, October 18th, right through today.
Yeah, we're not just skimming headlines. We're trying to dissect a system that's clearly under, profound stress.
That's the mission, isn't it? To provide the context you need to really understand this moment. Because October 18th, 2025, it wasn't just another Friday. It felt like a day packed with tension, with consequence.
Right. When you step back and look at the big picture, you really see these three massive forces just colliding. That's what defined these last 48 hours.
Exactly. First, you've got the government shutdown, 18 days long by Friday. A failure of the legislative branch that created this perfect operational vacuum.
Okay, vacuum number one. What's number two?
Number two, an incredibly assertive, really unilateral executive branch. They just moved decisively to fill that vacuum, didn't they? Both here at home and abroad.
And the third force, that has to be the public reaction.
The massive public dissent.
Yeah.
Symbolized by those huge No Kings protests we saw everywhere. And all of this, all of this is happening while the basic foundations, especially the federal judiciary, were basically teetering on the edge of complete operational failure.
It's like a perfect storm brewing. So for you, the listener, the core question we're trying to tackle here is fundamental, isn't it?
Absolutely. How are those bedrock principles of government, separation of powers, checks and balances, how are they actually holding up when one branch just steps away, leaves town, and another branch pushes right to the absolute outer limits of its power?
We have to start where it all began, right? The enabling crisis, that shutdown.
We must, because that legislative vacuum, that's the key variable. It unlocks almost every aggressive executive action we're about to dig into.
Okay, let's unpack this shutdown, because it's the backdrop, the context for literally everything else we're going to discuss today. Day 18 by Friday, and this isn't just, haggling over budget numbers. This feels like the legislative branch voluntarily just shutting down its own operation.
That's the critical piece, yeah.
Yeah.
It guarantees that almost anything the executive does goes largely unchecked, at least by Congress in real time.
And this legislative paralysis, it's the active ingredient, as you said, in this whole mix.
Exactly. The impasse feels intractable because the core issue isn't just money. It's deep policy disagreement. You've got the Democratic push for extending those Affordable Care Act, the ACA tax credits. That's a big one.
And Republicans are saying no.
Fundamentally refusing to grant that extension unless they get major concessions on their own policy priorities, especially around immigration enforcement. It's become a real sticking point.
And the public rhetoric around this has been, pretty sharp. A lot of finger pointing, trying to obscure who's actually responsible for the failure to govern.
Oh, absolutely. Classic blame game. The president has been out there very publicly, very aggressively, calling it a Democrat shutdown, a Schumer shutdown.
Right.
The White House narrative is crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying Democrats are obstructing government functioning specifically to block needed immigration enforcement measures.
Mm.
They're trying hard to shift the blame away from their own inability to get a budget passed onto the opposition's tactics.
And the Democrats' counterargument, they're focusing on the fact that Republicans just
left.
Right.
Precisely. Democratic leaders are hitting back, accusing Republicans of basically manufacturing this crisis and then just abandoning Washington for the weekend. They keep saying they were, ready, willing, and able to negotiate. But the Republicans simply adjourned both chambers.
So the blame game continues. But where does the political consequence actually land? Who are independent voters blaming for this mess?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. The polling that's out there suggests the administration's strategy of blaming Democrats isn't entirely working, at least not with everyone.
Oh.
While, nobody looks great in a shutdown.
Right.
Independent voters, that really crucial swing group, seem to show a slightly greater tendency to fault the Republicans in Congress and specifically the president.
So using the shutdown as leverage, it carries real political risk, even if it enables these executive actions we're seeing.
A significant risk, yes. And despite those high stakes, what did Congress actually do on Friday, October 18th?
Essentially nothing, right?
Complete operational standstill. The Senate tried and failed multiple times to advance any kind of funding bill before Majority Leader Thune just sent everyone home for the weekend. That guaranteed the shutdown would roll right into his fourth week.
And the house.
Even less. Just a 3-minute pro forma session. Barely blinked. Then adjourned. Congress, for all intents and purposes, just stopped functioning as any kind of check on executive power.
Okay, so that brings us to the really crucial part. The executive strategy within the shutdown. They didn't just sit back. They seemed to actively use the situation. How did they turn this crisis of governance into a tool for political leverage?
It looked like a very calculated, two-pronged approach. On one hand, targeted mitigation. On the other, deliberate aggression.
Mitigation first. What did that look like?
Well, the White House acted unilaterally to kind of take some political pressure points off the table. They found funds, presumably shifting things around, to keep paying active duty military members and the Coast Guard.
Ah, that's key. Because military pay is usually a huge pressure point to end shutdowns quickly.
Exactly. When the military doesn't get paid, the public outcry forces a resolution fast. By sort of insulating that key group, the administration basically got itself more time, more political space for a longer standoff.
Okay, that's the mitigation side. What about the aggression? Using the shutdown as a pretext for, well, cutting staff.
Yes. This is where the White House budget director, Russ Thott, you know, the one often called the Grim Reaper, for his focus on cutting the federal bureaucracy, really stepped in. He seemed to use the shutdown as justification to start actively initiating workforce reductions.
How many people are we talking about?
Reports indicate over 4,000 federal workers started getting layoff notices, with internal projections suggesting the total could eventually top 10,000. Now, this wasn't presented just as, you know, saving money during a lapse. It looked like an intentional move to strategically reshape the federal workforce using the crisis as cover.
But didn't the court step in on those specific firings pretty quickly?
They did. A federal judge issued a temporary restraining order, TRO, blocking those specific layoffs. And importantly, the judge cited concerns that these firings seemed to be politically motivated, not purely driven by, say, efficiency needs during the shutdown.
So there was a judicial check, at least temporarily.
A check, yes. But the intent of the executive to demonstrate force, to use the shutdown actively to start dismantling parts of the bureaucracy they dislike, that intent was made pretty clear.
Okay, so summing up this first part, the legislative vacuum created by the shutdown essentially created this permissive environment, an environment where the executive branch could just dominate the news cycle, act unilaterally,
and transform what should be a crisis of governance into a tool of executive power.
Precisely. The moment Congress effectively clocked out, the executive clocked right in, filling the void with a series of really controversial, really decisive moves. Which brings us to these domestic power plays.
These are the immediate consequences of that congressional absence. The first one was less about governing, more about, well, projecting strength.
Yeah, the first big domestic action we saw wasn't about policy documents or regulations. It was about 155-millimeter artillery shells. Let's talk about that military demonstration at Camp Pendleton down in Southern California.
Right. This was pure spectacle, seemingly designed to project federal strength at a very specific moment. Officially, it was called an amphibious capabilities demonstration, timed for the Marine Corps' 250th birthday. The stated goal was readiness, training.
But the political context completely overshadowed that, didn't it?
Entirely. I mean, this wasn't just some routine exercise. It was a high-profile event. You had Vice President J.D. Vance there, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth attending, and crucially, White House staff were explicitly telling reporters this was counter-programming.
Counter-programming against what?
Against the massive nationwide No Kings protests that were scheduled for that exact same day. So it was a very visual, very literal projection of federal military power, seemingly aimed right at the public dissent happening across the country.
And the way they executed this exercise immediately sparked a major fight between the federal government and the state of California, specifically Governor Gavin Newsom. What were the details there? What caused that big highway shutdown?
Okay, so the specific plan involved firing live 155-millimeter high-explosive artillery rounds from M777 howitzers. But the controversial part was where they were firing them, over Interstate 5.
Over I-5. That's one of the busiest, most critical highways on the entire West Coast.
Absolutely. Governor Newsom reacted fiercely. He called it an absurd show of force, accused the administration of putting his ego over responsibility, and basically said the president was using the U.S. military to intimidate people you disagree with. Strong words.
But didn't the military initially claim the highway wouldn't be affected?
They did. An early Marine Corps press release specifically stated no public highways or transportation routes will be closed. But at the same time, the federal government directed Amtrak and freight rail lines running parallel to I-5 to cancel their services. That already suggested they knew there was a risk.
So mixed signals. What actually happened with the highway?
Ultimately, the California Highway Patrol, the CHP, made the call. They had to close a section of I-5. Their reasoning was clear: an extreme life safety risk and distraction to drivers because of the proximity of these sudden, unexpected, and loud explosions.
Okay, hold on. So the federal government creates this extremely hazardous situation by firing artillery over a major highway.
Mm-hmm.
But then the state government, run by a political opponent, is forced to make the unpopular decision to actually shut the road down. That sounds like political judo.
That's exactly what critics called it, a calculated exploitation of federalism. Mm-hmm. And the White House rapid response team jumped on it immediately. They accused Governor Newsom of lying, insisted the Marines had said there were no public safety concerns. They essentially manufactured the danger, forced the state to take the heat for the disruption, and still got their dramatic show of force.
And the cost of this political theater wasn't trivial, was it?
Not at all. Estimates suggest the closure impacted around 80,000 travelers just on that day. It halted the movement of something like $94 million worth of freight that usually travels that corridor daily. And associated losses in visitor spending were pegged at over $8 million for the day.
So a clear message sent. The executive is willing to impose significant, measurable economic pain on a state, on citizens, really, to make a political point and project power against perceived opponents.
That seems to be the implication, yes. A very high-stakes form of political messaging.
Okay, from a show of military strengths, let's pivot to a different kind of executive action. A show of, well, rewarding political loyalty. The commutation of George Santos. This happened just before the weekend on October 17th, and it felt like a direct, almost constitutional-level reward for pure partisan loyalty.
It really did. This might be one of the clearest examples yet of the executive testing the absolute outer boundaries of a specific constitutional power, the clemency power. President Trump commuted the 87-month federal prison sentence of George Santos.
The former Republican representative convicted on some pretty serious charges, right? Wire fraud, identity theft.
Wire fraud, aggravated identity theft, yeah. Serious felonies. And Santos was released from federal prison in New Jersey just hours after the commutation was announced. It was incredibly swift.
What was really stunning, though, was the rationale. The president's public justification wasn't about, you know, mercy or rehabilitation or correcting a miscarriage of justice. It was explicitly political.
Completely. The justification offered had almost nothing to do with traditional judicial or fairness concerns. The president claimed Santos was horribly mistreated. He even bizarrely compared Santos's crimes favorably to unrelated statements made by Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal.
But the real kicker was the praise for Santos's voting record.
That was the core message, loud and clear.
Oh.
The president praised Santos because, quote, at least Santos had the courage, conviction, and intelligence to always vote Republican, end quote.
So, the takeaway is pretty blunt. Clemency, a power meant for mercy or correcting injustice, is being used here as an explicit reward for partisan allegiance.
It fundamentally changes the nature of that power, doesn't it? Now, technically, a commutation reduces or eliminates the sentence, but doesn't erase the conviction itself. That's what a pardon does.
Okay.
But reports indicate the executive order went further, potentially clearing Santos of outstanding fines and restitution payments as well. So it's not just letting him out of jail early, it's potentially wiping the financial slate clean too.
Which sends a powerful signal, doesn't it? That loyalty to the executive might just trump the consequences of federal law enforcement. It undermines the whole idea of an independent justice system.
That's the deep concern, yes.
Yeah.
It transforms clemency from a potential tool of justice into a transactional instrument, rewarding political allies and potentially deterring future cooperation with investigations against political figures.
Okay, so we've seen these domestic power plays enabled by the shutdown. This pattern of assertive, often unilateral, and highly transactional action seems to continue when we look beyond U.S. borders into the realm of global brinkmanship.
Absolutely. The shutdown might have silenced Congress domestically, but it also seemed to grant the president enormous leeway to create strategic uncertainty on the world stage.
And that executive assertiveness we just talked about domestically, it was definitely mirrored globally, creating, as you said, maximum uncertainty for allies and maybe even adversaries. The highest stakes example has to be the potential transfer of those Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine.
Right. Ukrainian President Zelensky's recent visit to D.C. was almost entirely focused on securing these long-range Tomahawk cruise missiles.
What makes the Tomahawk such a potential game changer in this conflict? Why is it so controversial?
It's all about the range. Tomahawks can travel up to 1,550 miles. That capability would suddenly allow Kievan to strike strategic targets deep, deep inside Russian territory. We're talking high-value military supply depots, crucial energy infrastructure, and, critically, potentially even targets in or near Moscow itself.
Wow. Okay, so that's a massive potential escalation, a direct threat to Russia's internal stability and its ability to wage war.
Exactly. Which is why the debate around supplying them is so intense. Proponents, obviously including President Zelensky, argue they're necessary now. They need to apply serious pressure on Putin, cripple the Russian war economy from within, and maybe finally force Russia to negotiate seriously.
And they argue the U.S. could control the risk.
They emphasize that the U.S. would maintain a crucial veto over the actual targeting. The missiles rely on GPS and other navigation systems that the U.S. controls, so theoretically, Washington could prevent strikes on certain targets deemed too escalatory.
But there must be huge resistance to this within the U.S. system, right? The Pentagon, intelligence agencies.
Oh, absolutely. Skeptics, particularly in the Pentagon and the intel community, raise two massive red flags. First, there's the issue of depleting U.S. stockpiles. These missiles are considered vital for potential conflicts in the Indo-Pacific region, particularly concerning China. Using them up in Ukraine is a major strategic trade-off.
And the second concern, the risk of escalation.
The profound risk of crossing a Russian red line. What would Putin do if Moscow were struck? Could it lead to what some analysts call a qualitatively new stage of escalation, perhaps involving tactical nuclear weapons or drawing NATO much closer to a direct conflict with a nuclear-armed Russia? The stakes are incredibly high.
And how did the president handle this incredibly delicate, high-stakes national security decision? Not with a clear policy, it seems.
No, it was handled with what looks like deliberate ambiguity. This seems to be personalized foreign policy in action.
Yeah.
President Trump publicly dangled the missile transfer as a direct threat to Putin, saying something like, if this war is not going to get settled, I'm going to send them Tomahawks.
Okay, so using it as leverage.
Exactly. But then, reportedly after a phone call with Putin, he publicly expressed doubts, specifically citing concerns about depleting U.S. supplies. He's playing both sides.
So the implication is he's turning this critical strategic decision, one affecting global stability, into a personal bargaining chip for his planned meeting with Putin in Hungary.
That certainly seems to be the interpretation of many observers. And this deliberate uncertainty is damaging in itself. It creates strategic confusion for our European allies who desperately need clarity on U.S. intentions. And it increases the risk of miscalculation by Moscow. Are the threats real? Is it just posturing for a domestic audience that ambiguity is dangerous?
This pattern of executive assertiveness pushing boundaries also extended south to Venezuela, didn't it?
Yeah.
With covert operations that sparked bipartisan anger in Congress because it looked an awful lot like an act of war without their approval.
Yes. President Trump confirmed that he had authorized CIA covert operations inside Venezuela. This came right on the heels of some earlier, very controversial, lethal U.S. military strikes against boats in the Caribbean, boats alleged to be involved in drug smuggling. Those strikes reportedly killed at least 27 people.
So a significant escalation of pressure against the Maduro regime in Venezuela. What was the administration's official rationale?
The public justification was framed strictly as a national security issue, focusing entirely on counter-narcotics. They cited the flow of drugs from South America and repeated claims, often disputed, that Venezuela was deliberately emptying their prisons into the United States.
And they used a specific legal justification for the military strikes.
Yes, and this is crucial. They designated the drug cartels operating in the region as unlawful combatants.
Wait a minute, unlawful combatants. That's language usually associated with wartime, like with Al-Qaeda or ISIS. They're applying it to drug smugglers.
That's precisely the move. By using that designation, the administration is attempting to place its actions within an armed conflict framework. This, they argue, legally justifies using lethal military force, potentially bypassing the need for explicit congressional authorization required for traditional acts of war under the Constitution.
So they're using a legal loophole, essentially, meant for counterterrorism, to justify military action potentially aimed at regime change in Venezuela. That sounds like a massive expansion of executive power through, well, linguistic games.
That is the core criticism, yes. And it generated significant bipartisan anger in Congress. Lawmakers accuse the administration of effectively committing an act of war without seeking congressional authorization. Senator Jeanne Shaheen warned the U.S. was sliding closer to outright conflict with no transparency, oversight, or apparent guardrails.
Yeah.
Even U.N. experts condemned the preceding boat strikes as likely violations of international law.
So this blurring of lines using a law enforcement or counter-narcotics justification for what looks like a foreign policy objective, potentially regime change, is incredibly risky.
It is, because the widely perceived actual objective isn't just stopping drugs. It's believed to be about creating a fracture within the Venezuelan military, hoping to compel them to abandon President Maduro. That's classic regime change strategy. The administration seems to be exploiting the counter-narcotics angle to get around the constitutional checks on presidential war-making power.
Okay, let's bring it back home for a moment. Because the executive branch wasn't just acting unilaterally abroad. They also tried to fundamentally reshape higher education here in the U.S. using federal funding as a lever. Tell us about this compact with universities.
Yeah, this is another really striking example of the executive branch trying to bypass the legislative process entirely to achieve major policy goals. The White House invited 9 very prominent universities, big names, to become the initial signatories of something called the Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education.
And the deal was basically sign on the dotted line, comply with our demands, and you get favorable access to federal research funding.
That's the core of it. Federal research grants are absolute lifeblood for major universities. So the offer was clear. Get on board, and you'll be favored in the queue for this critical funding. The implicit threat, of course, was equally clear. If you don't sign, your access to that vital research money could be jeopardized. It's financial coercion, essentially.
Let's get into the specifics. What exactly were they demanding these universities agree to? Because the report suggested it covered almost every aspect of university governance.
They were incredibly exhaustive, really dictating terms on how these institutions should operate, defining a new relationship based purely on compliance. Let's break it down. In admissions, the compact demanded universities prohibit considering factors like race, sex, ethnicity, nationality, or even political views in admissions decisions.
Okay.
And very controversially, it mandated the use of standardized tests like the SAT or ACT for all undergraduate applicants. This directly reverses the trend many universities have adopted towards holistic review and test optional policies.
Wow. Okay, what about campus dialogue and free speech? That's always a hot topic.
The section on ideas and speech was particularly forceful. It required institutions to actively foster a vibrant marketplace of ideas. Okay, standard enough. But then it specifically mandated the promotion of conservative viewpoints.
Explicitly promoting one viewpoint.
Explicitly. And furthermore, it mandated that universities adopt policies to use lawful force, think campus police or security, to ensure civility on campus. This could effectively turn university administrations into enforcers of specific ideological climates, all tied directly to their federal funding.
And hiring practices were also targeted, mandating specific criteria for faculty and staff.
Yes. The hiring section demanded selection based on rigorous and meritocratic selection based on objective and measurable criteria. And it explicitly barred considering factors like race, sex, or religion in hiring faculty or staff.
What about institutional neutrality? That sounds like it could silence universities on important issues.
That's a huge concern raised by critics. The compact required institutional neutrality. This meant that university employees, acting in their official capacities like the university president or official departments, would have to abstain from actions or speech relating to societal and political events.
So no university statements on climate change, racial justice, foreign policy, anything controversial.
Potentially. It could effectively muzzle universities from taking public stances on almost any major societal issue, which is something many institutions see as part of their public service mission.
Were there other demands? Financial or operational?
Yes, a few more big ones. Signatories had to agree to freeze tuition for American students for 5 full years. They had to cap the enrollment of international undergraduate students at just 15% of the total undergrad population. And they had to define sex based strictly on biological criteria at birth for the purposes of facilities, like dorms and bathrooms, and also for sports teams.
Okay, the overall picture here is pretty clear. This is the executive branch using the power of the federal purse, completely sidestepping Congress, to try and enforce ideological conformity and specific policy outcomes across the higher education sector, a sector traditionally protected by principles of academic independence.
That's the core implication, yes. It attempts to redefine the relationship between the federal government and academia from one that was, at least aspirationally, a partnership based on shared goals of research and education to one based purely on transactional compliance with federally dictated terms.
And how did the universities react? Was there resistance to this approach?
Resistance was immediate and quite strong. Several of the major institutions invited to be initial signatories, including big names like MIT, the University of Pennsylvania, and USC, publicly rejected the compact almost immediately. They cited grave concerns about academic freedom, institutional autonomy, and the potential damage to their educational missions.
And it wasn't just individual universities.
No. Over 30 different higher education organizations, representing a broad swath of colleges and universities across the country, jointly called for the White House to withdraw the proposal entirely. They saw it as a fundamental threat to the independence and integrity of American higher education. So the administration tried to use transactional power, but it met significant unified pushback from the sector itself.
Now, these aggressive executive actions, Camp Pendleton, Santos, the University Compact, the foreign policy moves, they didn't happen in a vacuum, did they? They were met specifically on Friday, October 18th, by this massive organized public counter-mobilization, the No Kings protests.
Absolutely. This wasn't just a few scattered demonstrations. We need to understand the sheer scale of the public opposition that manifested that day.
How big are we talking? This wasn't just a DC thing or a coastal thing.
No, this was truly nationwide. Reports suggest millions of people participated in over 2,700 separate demonstrations. That's across all 50 states. Plus, there were solidarity protests popping up in cities in Europe as well.
Millions. Any specific crowd estimates for major cities?
The estimates are, as always, a bit varied, but some were huge. Organizers and some media outlets estimated up to 500,000 people in San Francisco alone. Chicago and New York City both saw crowds well exceeding 100,000 people. These were massive turnouts.
And what was the unifying message? What brought all these people out across so many different places, presumably with different local grievances?
The core message seemed to be remarkably unified, cutting across different groups. It was fundamentally a constitutional challenge. A direct rejection of what participants saw as executive overreach, creeping authoritarianism. The slogan itself, "There are no kings in the United States," really captured that core sentiment.
So it wasn't just about one specific policy.
No, it seemed to be a confluence of grievances. People were protesting the perceived use of clemency to reward loyalty with Santos, the provocative military display at Camp Pendleton, the real-world impacts of the government shutdown, frustration over aggressive immigration tactics. It all kind of funneled into this broader message about defending democratic norms against an overly powerful executive.
And the style, the symbolism of the protests that seemed very deliberate too, framed not as anti-government, but as a defense of the American system.
That's a crucial distinction, yes. Overwhelmingly, the reports emphasized that the protests were peaceful. Often they adopted an almost festive rather than angry atmosphere. Which, of course, runs counter to the narrative sometimes pushed about protesters being inherently disruptive or violent.
And the symbols they use.
We saw some interesting, slightly quirky symbols, like the widespread use of inflatable animal costumes, especially frogs, for some reason, becoming a kind of visual shorthand for resistance. But more importantly, more fundamentally, you saw countless banners and signs specifically invoking the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, starting with, "We the People." They were framing their dissent explicitly as a defense of the Republic's foundations against centralized power.
So how did the administration respond to this massive, unified display of public opposition?
It was a real mix of dismissal and what you might call narrative warfare. The president himself publicly mocked the whole King characterization, tried to downplay the turnout numbers.
But didn't his own campaign lean into it?
Bizarrely, yes. At the same time the president was dismissing it, his campaign's social media account posted this video montage depicting him, the president, wearing a crown, like a monarch. It was incredibly provocative, seemed almost designed to troll the protesters by embracing the very symbol they were rejecting.
And the Camp Pendleton event, we already discussed, was basically part of that response, too, a physical show of counterforce.
Explicitly. It was officially described by aides as counterprogramming. And beyond that, we saw Republican governors in several states, notably Texas and Virginia, activating National Guard troops in anticipation of the protests, signaling a readiness to respond forcefully if any disorder did break out, which largely it did not.
So this really set up a critical battle over narratives, didn't it? A fight over the very definition of American patriotism.
Absolutely. The administration and its allies worked hard to frame the protesters as fundamentally un-American. They tried to link them to broad, delegitimizing labels, calling them communists or Hamas sympathizers, trying to paint them as outside the bounds of acceptable dissent.
Well, the protesters framed their actions completely differently.
Completely differently. They framed their actions as the defense of the Republic's democratic foundations, a defense of constitutional limits on power, directly echoing the language and spirit of the American Revolution against, well, a king. So October 18th really staged this dramatic public duel between two competing visions of American allegiance. Is it loyalty to the leader, or is it allegiance to the principles of limited government and the Constitution itself?
Okay, so while the executive branch and the public were locked in this high-profile battle of actions and reactions, the other institutions, the ones meant to provide checks and balances, were struggling just to keep the lights on. The most acute crisis point seems to be the federal judiciary.
Yeah, this is a story that got somewhat less headline attention amidst the protests and executive actions, but it's potentially just as consequential. We're talking about a truly unprecedented institutional failure. The entire third branch of the federal government, the branch tasked with upholding the rule of law, officially ran out of operating money on Friday, October 18th.
Ran out of money entirely? How does that even happen?
They had been stretching things out for over 2 weeks, using funds that aren't subject to annual appropriation, things like court filing fees, other miscellaneous income. But those non-appropriated funds were exhausted. The money allocated by Congress for this fiscal year never arrived because of the shutdown. So the coffers were empty.
What does that mean, practically speaking, for the courts? What happens when the judiciary is operationally bankrupt?
It means they have to shift immediately to operating under the rules of the Anti-Deficiency Act. That's the law designed to stop government agencies from spending money they don't have. Starting Monday, October 20th, the judiciary moves to performing only accepted activities.
Accepted meaning what? Only the absolute essentials?
Pretty much. Work deemed essential to continue exercising the core Article 3 judicial powers, basically. Hearing and deciding cases. But the fallout from this is massive. Most non-essential court staff across the country will be furloughed, sent home without pay. And even the Supreme Court building itself, the physical symbol of justice, will be closed to the public.
How badly will this impact the day-to-day administration of justice for ordinary people and businesses?
The impact is going to be seismic, particularly on the civil side of the justice system. Criminal cases generally will have to continue because of constitutional rights, like the right to a speedy trial. But civil litigation, especially cases involving the federal government itself, is facing widespread disruption.
So lawsuits against the government, regulatory enforcement, all slowing down.
Grinding to a halt in many cases. We're already seeing government agencies like the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, filing motions in courts across the country seeking stays, basically asking judges to pause their civil cases because the government lawyers are being furloughed or can't fully operate. The FTC even announced it was suspending all of its non-merger-related civil investigations entirely.
Wow. So the gears of civil justice are just stopping for potentially millions of cases, creating huge backlogs down the road.
Huge backlogs, massive delays. It's a fundamental disruption to the rule of law for anything not deemed absolutely essential or criminal.
And yet here's the paradox. Even as it's running out of money and facing operational collapse, the Supreme Court is still being forced to rule on some of the nation's most heated, most politically charged disputes. It's both a victim of this political failure and the ultimate arbiter of it.
That's the profound irony of this moment, isn't it? Just days before hitting this funding cliff, on October 15th, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a truly landmark case, Louisiana v. Calais.
This is the case about the Voting Rights Act.
Exactly. A case concerning the potential weakening of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That's the absolute cornerstone provision that prohibits racially discriminatory voting practices or procedures. It's been fundamental to protecting minority voting rights for decades.
And what were the signals coming out of those arguments? Does Section 2 look like it's in trouble?
Based on the questioning from the justices, particularly the conservative majority, yes, it appears to be in significant trouble. The justices seemed quite receptive to arguments from Louisiana that would significantly curtail the scope of Section 2, making it much harder for minority groups to win lawsuits challenging things like racially gerrymandered electoral maps or discriminatory voting laws.
So a ruling that weakens the VRA could have immediate major partisan consequences, right? Especially with redistricting battles always ongoing.
huge consequences. It could dramatically reshape the political landscape in many states by making it much harder to ensure fair representation for minority voters. So you have this incredible situation. The court, financially crippled by partisan gridlock in Congress, is simultaneously being asked to decide a case with enormous partisan implications, a case that goes right to the heart of the political process that failed to fund it.
Beyond the Supreme Court, were other federal courts still managing to function right up until the shutdown cliff?
They kept the routine work going right up to the wire. On October 17th, the day before the money ran out, the Supreme Court did issue an order denying an injunction in a complex case involving school districts, but they didn't release any new opinions on the 18th itself. Similarly, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit released a few opinions, one precedential, two non-precedential, on the 17th, but then nothing on the 18th. It's like the judiciary was trying to maintain this facade of institutional normalcy in its core work, even as the operational foundation was crumbling beneath it.
Meanwhile, back on Capitol Hill, Congress remained completely paralyzed, as we said, that brief pro forma session in the House. And when Congress can't actually govern, can't pass laws or budgets, it often resorts to just signaling, right? Using non-binding resolutions to make political points.
Exactly. Legislative signaling becomes the main activity. And looking at the resolutions introduced just before they left on October 17th gives you a snapshot of member priorities and political messaging, even when they can't actually legislate.
What kinds of signals were they sending?
You could group them thematically. For instance, there were resolutions focused on foreign relations and diaspora communities, like HRE's 819. That was from Representative Swatsey, formally recognizing the contributions of the Indian American community and condemning recent anti-Indian, anti-Sikh, and anti-Hindu hate incidents. A way to connect with a specific constituency.
Were there resolutions that acted as a direct critique or rebuke of the administration's actions, the things people were protesting about?
Yes, definitely. A key example there would be HRA's 815, introduced by Representative Khanna. It explicitly called for much greater transparency and accountability for ICE and Customs and Border Protection, CBP operations, specifically demanding things like mandatory body cameras for agents and the establishment of independent civilian oversight boards.
That sounds like a direct response to the administration's aggressive immigration tactics and the concerns driving some of the No Kings protests.
It absolutely reads that way. It's a method for members of Congress, particularly those in the opposition, to register their criticism and propose alternative policies, even when they lack the power to implement them due to the shutdown or political divisions.
Were there also resolutions aligning more with the president's America First agenda, pushing back against international bodies, for example?
Yes, we saw that too. HRA's 812, sponsored by Representative Andy Biggs, a strong administration ally. This one condemned a proposal being floated at the UN's International Maritime Organization to potentially impose a global tax on shipping emissions to fund climate initiatives. Biggs framed it as an illegitimate global carbon tax that threatens U.S. sovereignty and economic interests.
So these resolutions, they don't change any laws, but they allow lawmakers to stake out their ideological territory, communicate with their base, show they're doing something, even when the fundamental work of governing has completely stopped.
Precisely. It's governing by press release, in a sense, when the actual levers of power are unavailable.
Okay, one last piece of the institutional puzzle. The State Department. While the White House was conducting this very personalized, often disruptive foreign policy on tomahawks in Venezuela, was the traditional diplomatic machinery at state still trying to operate on a more institutional track?
It seems so. There's evidence of this dual-track foreign policy operating even during the shutdown. The State Department continued with some routine diplomatic functions. They issued standard statements, for example, on News National Day and Iraq's National Day. There were readouts released of Secretary Rubio's meetings with the foreign ministers of Liberia and Mexico. Normal diplomatic business.
But was there anything more significant coming out of state on October 18th?
Yes. The most notable action was a formal media note they issued that day. It warned of what they called credible reports indicating an imminent ceasefire violation by Hamas against the people of Gaza.
That sounds like a coordinated multilateral effort, not a unilateral move.
It's exactly. The statement emphasized that the U.S. had coordinated its concerns with guarantor nations involved in the ceasefire monitoring, and it threatened unspecified protective measures if Hamas were to violate the truce. This is the State Department operating through traditional diplomatic channels, working with allies, issuing formal warnings, trying to maintain stability. It stands in pretty stark contrast to the personalized brinkmanship we saw coming directly from the White House on other issues.
But even the State Department, the face of U.S. diplomacy abroad, wasn't immune to the shutdown's practical effects, right?
No, not at all. That's the ultimate irony. Even as they were trying to conduct this high-level diplomacy, their own public-facing operations were hampered. They had a prominent warning on their website stating that updates would be limited until full government operations resumed, directly curtailing public transparency about U.S. foreign policy.
And security concerns, too.
Yes. On the same day, October 18th, a security alert was issued for the U.S. Embassy down in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and Tobago. It advised American citizens there to exercise caution due to a heightened state of alert. So you have this duality. The institution trying to carry on its procedural diplomatic work, but simultaneously strained by the financial chaos and potential security vulnerabilities stemming from the government breakdown back home.
Okay, we have covered a tremendous amount of ground, dissecting these intense 48 hours of federal activity in granular detail. Let's try to synthesize this. What's the big picture takeaway from this profound collision we've witnessed?
Well, I think what we saw concentrated in those 48 hours, particularly on October 18th, 2025, was really a near complete breakdown of the intended constitutional balance. You had aggressive executive unilateralism on full display. Think about the transactional use of clemency for Santos, the political theater and coercion of Camp Pendleton, the deliberate ambiguity around the tomahawks, the covert actions in Venezuela justified by, well, creative legal definitions, the attempt to impose ideological conformity on universities through the compact, just relentless assertion of executive power.
And all of this was directly enabled by legislative failure. The 18-day shutdown wasn't just a backdrop. It was the key that unlocked the door, removing congressional oversight and opposition when it was most needed.
Precisely. And this executive assertiveness, enabled by legislative absence, was then met by that massive public countermobilization, the No Kings protests, a direct challenge from the citizenry, all while the third branch, the judiciary, the institution theoretically meant to arbitrate these disputes and uphold the law,
was caught right in the crossfire, forced to rule on fundamental political conflicts like the Voting Rights Act case, while simultaneously running out of money and facing operational collapse due to the political branch's failure.
The shutdown was the critical variable. It allowed the executive branch to aggressively probe, maybe even redraw, the outer limits of its constitutional authority across almost every conceivable policy domain. In a sense, the government wasn't paralyzed. Power was just becoming intensely centralized in one branch.
So these events, particularly on October 18th, served as a really critical stress test, a stress test for the separation of powers, for the rule of law itself. We watched the executive try to govern by transaction, by fiat, by sheer assertion of will. Congress stood idle, and the courts were slowly suffocating financially.
And that brings us to the final, maybe provocative thought we want to leave you with today, especially as you process all the details we've laid out in this deep dive. In this kind of environment where the traditional boundaries between the branches seem so porous, so contested, what is ultimately more fragile? Is it the operational capacity of the government itself, the simple ability to keep the lights on, pay the staff, process the paperwork, as we see failing in the judiciary?
Or is it something deeper?
Or is it the constitutional norms, the unwritten rules, the assumptions of good faith engagement between the branches that the whole system relies on? Norms we see being challenged by things like the explicit use of the clemency power to reward partisan loyalty. What happens? What are the long-term consequences when the institutions tasked with providing impartial justice become politically and financially dependent on the very institutions they are constitutionally designed to check? That, I think, is the fundamental vulnerability that this entire 48-hour period has starkly and perhaps dangerously laid bare.